Welcome to episode 322 of the Entertainment 2.0 podcast, brought to you by thedigitalmediazone.com. I'm your host and producer, Josh Pollard.
And I'm your host, Richard Gunther, and this is the show where we talk about Microsoft Entertainment technology, including audio, video, gaming, and more across all Windows platforms. Hey, Josh, how are you doing?
Not too bad. You were gone last week, right?
What?
Were you gone last week, or was that 2 weeks ago?
That was 2 weeks ago.
All right, well, either way, I'm glad to have you here this week, Richard.
Well, obviously you don't even notice.
No, life has just been that crazy.
I get it. I've been traveling every single week to some degree, and I'm going to be gone again next week. So you're back with another co-host again next week.
Apparently. Yeah, I totally knew that and planned ahead. Yeah. Uh-huh. So... How about instead we just jump into some listener feedback? We've got one email this week. It was sent from Chris to our address at entertainment20@thedigitalmediazone.com. If you want to use your voice, you can call into our voicemail box at 877-856-4933. But Chris writes, I am a longtime listener of your show and never miss an episode. Your show is fantastic. End of standard preamble. I wish every email started that way. We should just tack that on to any email that doesn't have that, Richard.
Yeah, I like that. We could probably just put that in the email script.
That works for me. All right. So he says, I've been running Windows 7 Media Center in Australia for many years and recently upgraded to a new PC based on a low-profile case. I'm using an onboard Intel graphics and a generic HDTV. I have 6 tuners, 4 Hapag, and 2 others, but I don't remember the brand. They are free-to-air tuners, etc., and they work flawlessly. However, I'm having the following issues. Issue number 1. When the PC wakes up from sleep, it sometimes goes into continuous repeating handshake loop. He means like HDCP handshakes, with no video. To fix it, I have to crawl around to the back of the TV, unplug the HDMI cable temporarily, and after reconnecting, I get video. I was able to fix this by installing an NVIDIA card, but as I don't have a low-profile NVIDIA card, that's not a viable option. So I'm guessing he's just left the case off the top and it's sticking out.
Yeah, that's usually our number one fix recommendation.
Right. And so do we just want to handle these in order, or do we want to read them all and come back to them?
I think we're going to need to pause between each of these.
All right. So one option there is just get a low-profile NVIDIA card. I'm sure they make low-profile NVIDIA cards. I'm guessing that he just had this one laying around the house, though. So that's one option, although I'm really kind of amazed that the onboard Intel graphics are giving him headaches. It usually doesn't... I can't think of anybody who's had HDCP weird issues like this with Intel onboard graphics, but we also don't know specifically which motherboard he's got or which version of the Intel HD graphics he's using. So not really sure there. You got any other ideas?
Well, the other idea is that thing that we occasionally recommend that you throw on to fix the HDMI stuff.
Yep. That would be the Geffen HDMI Detective.
I'm glad you remembered the name of it.
The only problem with that is that it's fairly pricey. It's probably going to cost you more than an NVIDIA low-profile graphics card. It could just be drivers, which is, you know, something that Rennie mentions in the chat. You know, I tend to just assume that people are trying the latest version of drivers, but, you know, maybe not. So try updating your drivers. Other than that, I guess I'm not entirely sure, especially not without knowing more specifics on what version of the Intel HD graphics he's running there. The other issue there is that he's using sleep, which leads us into the second problem. He says, when waking from sleep, Media Center always goes into windowed mode in the top left-hand corner. I then need to find a mouse and maximize to full screen, which is a real pain. Why can't I lock Media Center to full screen?
That's crazy.
That is crazy.
I've never seen that happen before.
I have a solution to both of these problems.
Oh?
Stop putting the computer to sleep.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a really good idea. I honestly wish that I had the patience to try and figure out what I need to do to get that. It's not really sleep, but isn't there some sort of like low power mode so that you don't miss recordings?
Well, there's different levels of sleep. I can never remember what the different numbers are and what they necessarily mean. But even if your computer's asleep, Media Center is smart enough to wake it up and in time for recordings, supposedly. I've never had success with sleep, though. So I just don't let my home theater PCs go to sleep. I know it uses more energy, but it's a more reliable experience.
Right. That's how I feel, too. And I don't necessarily want to have to wait that much longer while things wake up. And who knows what that might tend to do with anything that's running. Now, a couple things coming through in the chat. Antoine is suggesting that maybe make sure that while it's full screen, that you exit it to the desktop so that it remembers that when it starts up, it should be in full screen mode.
That's a good idea. Yeah. He also recommends, especially now with the different video card, or even without the different video card, try redoing all of the video setup stuff inside of Media Center. But that's not always fun to do that, but it could potentially fix some issues. Also, as we like to remind people, look in the event viewer to see if there's any messages in there that might be helpful as to what's going on with your computer when it's having these issues. All right, let's move on to the next one. Number three. There's only four issues here. Don't worry. Issue number three, PowerDVD.
Number seven.
Yeah. PowerDVD version 14 does not appear to integrate with Media Center. This worked well with PowerDVD 12, but version 14 won't allow me to watch Blu-ray from within Media Center, and I need to go to the native PowerDVD application. Now, what I'm not sure of here is what he means by native or you know built in to Media Center, because I think the version of PowerDVD that I have is either 12 or 13, and the only part that's in Media Center is really just the launcher. It still ends up launching out to the actual PowerDVD app, if I remember correctly. You're not a PowerDVD user at all, so you're just going to have to wait.
I use ArcSoft, and of course, I have the last version of that that frankly exists, and Total Media Theater does have a, quote, native mode. I imagine what it's doing is it's just kind of running the actual application, but with different Chrome.
Yeah, probably, which I think is essentially what PowerDVD has done. But it's been a really long time since I've even tried to watch a Blu-ray on my home theater PC. Now I just use my Xbox. But, you know, if it's just that PowerDVD 14 doesn't have a tile in Media Center, there's lots of ways to add a tile to Media Center that would launch it. I imagine that Relaunch from Chris Barnes could probably do it. And then there's apps like the one that we talked about last week, Media Center Reset Toolbox, I think it was called, allows you to customize the start screen in Media Center. So you could probably add a shortcut to PowerDVD with that. I mean, there's lots of different ways of customizing that start screen. So if that's all you're missing, then there's probably a solution for that there. Unfortunately, your solution of using ArcSoft isn't going to work either, since that's not even available for sale anymore.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a dead-end path. Don't go that way.
Right. All right. Let's move on to the last issue. He says, I don't have surround sound speakers. But frankly, that's the issue. That's a separate issue in and of itself. He says, I use two high-quality amplified stereo speakers plus a subwoofer connected to the audio out on the TV. When I watch DVDs, the sound level is fine, and I can hear all tracks easily, including vocals and the background sound, etc. However, when watching Blu-ray, I can barely hear the vocals in the middle channel and have to increase the sound level substantially, which makes the watching experience very painful and unusable. I've set PowerDVD to the noisy environment setting, which helps slightly, but the vocals in the center channel are still too quiet. Any suggestions on what to do to fix this?
This is interesting, right? Because if I remember correctly, most DVDs that have 5.1 tracks also have stereo tracks. And if his system is smart enough to play those, then he's set. I don't think that is the case with Blu-rays. I think Blu-rays basically default down to a lower quality 5.1 track. So he needs to make sure that Media Center and Windows are set up knowing that he only has two front speakers and a subwoofer. That's thing one. And then thing two would be to see if there's any setting in, and I don't know about this, but I would imagine there's a setting in the Power DVD player that does some sort of mix down that would allow him to play a 5.1 audio track and have it come through the 2.1 setup that he has. What's happening is the middle channel just isn't getting represented anywhere.
Yeah, that's not good. Hopefully all of the suggestions that you've passed on will fix those problems. It sounds like the two easy solutions to all four of his problems are don't put your computer to sleep and don't use Power DVD. But that second one is an even harder problem to solve because Blu-ray on a home theater PC is just a tricky situation. Actually, you know what the solution is there? Rip all of your Blu-rays, but that's a whole nother bag of worms.
Well, but it is and it isn't because it depends what format you want, right?
If you absolutely want
everything that came with your Blu-ray, including different audio tracks and subtitles specifically, then you really need to rip it to an ISO or to its own native format, and then you still need the player.
Right. Yeah, yeah, that's it's a whole different set of problems when you go down that road, for sure. All right, well, Chris, hopefully we were able to help you at least a little bit. Let us know what you come up with over the next couple of weeks, because, you know, we want everybody to have a fully functioning and stable home theater PC. We also got a follow-up from Peter. He was the one that wrote in last week talking about the scripts that he had written for backing up his recorded TV shows. And he just wrote a couple of scripts using RoboCopy to copy those files off, and then he scheduled them. But he didn't send us the scripts last week, and we asked on the show if he could do that. So he sent us those scripts. We'll make them available in the show notes for you to download if you want to try to set up a similar scenario on your own Windows Media Center PC. But that's it for the listener feedback this week. So why don't we jump into some news?
All right, let's do it. So right, let's start with video. You know, I have the Amazon Fire TV stick.
And do you actually use it?
Well, that's another story. And I have the Chromecast and I have the Roku. Here we have all of these like HDMI sticks that you can just plug in, and they're the perfect solution for TV, right?
Well, they're the perfect solution for those individual silos, basically. And that's probably not entirely fair. The Amazon Fire TV stick is a great solution for getting Amazon content and Netflix and lots of other things. The Roku gives you access to lots of things. The Chromecast, of course, has its unique casting capabilities. But in the Windows world, The feature that we want the most typically is Miracast, the ability to just straight up stream from a mobile device to your big screen. And to do that, you typically need another one of these types of sticks or dongles or boxes or something plugged into your TV, or sometimes the TVs themselves natively support Miracast, but a lot of them don't. So you got to get a third party thing. And when Amazon announced the Fire TV stick last year and made it available for so cheap, I mean, it's $40, but when they first launched, you could get it for $20, and they said it would support Miracast, I was really excited. And then we found out that, yeah, the Miracast support wasn't very good. Well, this week they updated the Fire TV stick, and one of the things that they were addressing was Miracast support. And they made it better for Windows users. And by Windows users, I mean like grabbing your Windows 8 tablet and trying to stream content from a Windows 8 tablet or maybe a Windows phone device to the Fire TV stick. And it's more usable now. It works. But I was over at withinraphael.com. This is Rafael Rivera's blog. He is a longtime Windows developer type person. He's always hacking on the latest Windows development bits. And he's tested out a whole bunch of different devices that can support Miracast and measured the latency on all of them and has made a beautiful little chart on how well they all work. And so he updated his Fire TV stick this week and found out that, yeah, it works a little better, but it is exponentially slower than everything else in this list. You know, for most of these latencies, and these are in milliseconds, you see them ranging anywhere from, you know, 83 to like the mid 100s, 200s, 300s range milliseconds here.
Yeah, yeah. What I love about this, I just love this. I mean, I don't want you to say this in milliseconds, because I think the thing that's beautiful about this is that this isn't in milliseconds, this is in seconds.
Yes. So let's, for all of you who don't like doing the conversion here, so like, let's just take Microsoft's screen sharing for Lumia phones. That's 150 milliseconds. That's 0.15 seconds. Okay. That's probably barely noticeable. The Amazon Fire TV stick, 2.9 seconds, almost 3 seconds of latency. So like, if you want to do a PowerPoint, maybe that's doable. Maybe you just want to share some photos. But like, if you're trying to do full-on screen sharing, like just using your TV as a secondary monitor, forget about it. That ain't happening with an Amazon Fire TV stick.
Right. Or any sort of gaming at all, period.
Right. So this, you know, I just discovered this chart of his today, and it's really nice. It looks like the cost to performance ratio here has, you know, the Microsoft device isn't horrible at $70 for 150 milliseconds of latency, but the let's see here, I would say maybe the better one is the Microsoft Wireless Display Adapter at just under $60 for 83 milliseconds. That's probably your best value there, except for maybe the Netgear push to TV, which is just under $50 for 116 milliseconds of latency. So I don't know. You looking to pick up any of these, Richard?
No. I mean, I don't really have any use for Miracast. My TV actually has Miracast built in, and the things that I'm using the Amazon TV stick for really are just Android TV apps. So it has what I need. Just the process that you have to go through to get to Miracast on the Fire TV stick is ridiculous. You have to go through a series of menus to a specific option, and then you have to enable it, and then you can share to it. It's just ridiculous. I mean, this is why I hate to say this, but this is why AirPlay is awesome and Miracast will fail on Windows, because the hardware manufacturers that are implementing it just don't get it.
Well, yeah, AirPlay's a lot easier when it's a mostly closed ecosystem. So, I mean, if you're just going like iPhone or iPad to an Apple TV, that's something that they can pretty easily control. So you would absolutely expect that to work really, really, really well.
Well, sure. But even Chromecast or casting from a Chromecast piece of software to the associated apps that might exist on a DLNA device also works almost flawlessly. So Google can do it. Apple can do it. What doesn't work all that well is this glorious open source solution that's out there. Surprise!
Yeah, sometimes open standards don't work out for the best. Sometimes, not always.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on to the next story here. We've got an update to the Plex app, and this is kind of an unusual update. So So we've got version 2 of the Plex app for Windows. And when I say Windows, in this case, I mean like Windows 8.1 PCs and tablets, not phones. Although I believe the phone app got updated too, but it didn't get this one update, which is the price. In the US, that price has been $5 for the Plex app. They've now made the app free and gone with the sort of in-app purchase model for paying for it. And there's one major benefit to that is that it basically gives you demo access to the app. Although there's ways of doing trials, so I'm not sure why they didn't do that initially. But anyway, the app is now free, but with the major limitation of you can only play back music and videos for 1 minute, because 1 minute should be enough to let you know if it works for you. And you might be able to argue that that's not enough time, but that's what they've done. And then if it works for you, then you can use an in-app purchase to pay for it, which is fine. But the other thing that they've done is that if you're a Plex Pass subscriber, if you just sign in with your Plex Pass, you don't have to pay for the app separately.
Really nice.
Yeah, it's really nice. I haven't bought any of the apps because I don't use Plex that much, because I don't have a huge movie library. But I do have Plex Pass because I want to continue using it on my Xbox One, and it's still required to use it on the Xbox One. So I have an interesting little workaround. If for some reason, like, this is kind of dumb, because if you're paying for Plex Pass, you're probably paying $5 a month, which is the cost of one of these apps anyway. But if you haven't bought the apps and didn't want to, you can now get the Windows app, which is free, sign in with your Plex Pass account, it's free, and then because it's a universal app, download it on your Windows phone, because you've already quote-unquote purchased it on Windows. And then again, just sign in with your Plex Pass, and everything's golden. So I've been using these apps a lot more over the last couple of days, trying to put them through their paces, because I haven't actually used them on Windows or Windows Phone. And they're pretty nice. The Windows Phone version works really well. That's amazingly the one that I've used the most. When you have a phone with a 6-inch screen, watching video on it doesn't seem so ludicrous. So I've done a lot of that with the Plex app on my Windows phone. And, you know, the content is laid out about how you'd expect. It's pretty well Metro, or however you want to describe that design language.
Windows?
Sure, I guess. Well, but when you say Windows, that kind of leans more towards their new design language with hamburger menus all over the place and stuff like that. And
I'm not convinced that is a design language.
It's not like that. It's more original Metro, which is still really nice. So it looks good. It works really well. They've also added a couple of new features here. The main one being that you can now, and I think this makes the most sense on the phone, you can control what they call remote players. So I haven't been able to try this on the Xbox One yet, but like on a PC or even on a phone, you can set those devices up as remote players. And then those can be controlled by other devices. So I can grab my phone, search through my library there, and then say, play this on, and it'll give me a list of all of the other remote players on my network. And I can just say, play this on my PC or play this on my, you know, TV or whatever. And I imagine this is probably supported on their other apps, like their Roku apps and things like that. But I don't know, because I don't have those devices. So that's really great. But then tonight I tried doing all of this on my main Windows PC, which is also where my Plex server is running. And I couldn't get any videos to play back. I tried playing off of the server that, you know, one of our listeners has shared with me. None of his stuff would play back. But when I initially set this up on a laptop earlier in the week and played remotely, everything played fine. So I don't know what's going on with my home desktop, and it doesn't really give me any error messages. It just never plays. Assuming that's just a fluke with this computer, I'm really impressed with these apps. And if you're a Plex user, definitely check these out. The other thing that I do like, and we mentioned this before when they rolled out this feature, is the sync functionality. So that, you know, if you're about to go on a trip, right from within the Plex app, you can go through your library and pick some movies or TV shows, and then there's just a little sync button, you know, that will download that movie or TV show straight to your mobile device, and you can adjust quality levels and stuff so that it's maybe not, you know, you're probably not going to want to download a 30 gig Blu-ray rip to your phone. That would be kind of silly, but you know, you can set those quality levels so you end up with smaller files that are more appropriate for your mobile device. And that works really, really well.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there are other ways, of course, to watch video on a Windows PC or on a Windows phone, and that would be through Microsoft's amazing video app. Okay, I'm really just kind of kidding. But obviously, they do have the Xbox music and video apps, and both of them have updates available through the preview program now. So if you're testing Windows 10, there are new preview apps available that will work only on Windows 10. And these are essentially early releases that are available only to the Windows insiders, and they are not complete. So don't get upset when they don't do everything that the existing Xbox video and audio apps currently do. For example, you can play your music and videos, you can stream purchase videos, you can listen to music through Xbox Music Pass, you can listen to music from playlists, but you can't access the store. You can't browse anything. You actually can't do that through this version of the app. So,
well, and you won't be able to at all going forward. It's not going to be part of the apps.
No, but I thought that it at least was going to kind of give you a launching point into the store, kind of like the iOS apps do.
Oh, that could be. I'm not really sure. But yeah, they're moving all of that. Just, this isn't news here, but just in case our listeners didn't know, all of the music and video purchase stuff is being moved into the regular store. So the place where you're going to get apps and games now is also the place where you'll go to get music and video purchases. So I tried these out. I doubt you did.
Oh, you did?
Because you're not running Windows 10 on anything yet, right?
No, not yet.
So I did briefly try these out tonight, and it's fairly briefly because they just came out a couple of hours ago. The music app is fine. It's mostly functional, like you said, although it is definitely missing some features. You know, the now playing screen is it's a lot more like the Xbox, the app on the Xbox One, where frustratingly the now playing artwork is just the one album artwork for whatever album it is that the song that you're listening to is from, whereas the previous Windows 8.1 music app, now playing, would cycle through lots of different photos of the artist that you're listening to, which I always really, really liked. And it just doesn't do that in this. I'm hoping they're going to bring that feature in. But it did all of the syncing stuff of my library and showed me music that was on OneDrive and all that. So I don't have huge complaints. Again, it's super early. The video app was far less usable. I had weird issues trying to play back some things. I tried playing a direct Blu-ray rip. I didn't get any audio. I tried another one. I tried a DVD rip. It didn't work at all. It just gave me an error message. I then tried playing an MP4 of a TV show, and I could hear it, but it didn't actually show the video. It was like it wasn't playing. It didn't think a video was playing, but I could hear it. So the video app is super buggy, and I guess just wait for some updates to that. But they're all through the store, and I imagine we'll be getting pretty frequent updates to those apps.
Yeah, I would assume so. Now, I'm looking at the screen caps of these apps, and they're, I don't know, kind of uninspiring.
Yeah.
I'm hoping they ultimately look better than that.
Yeah, they're pretty bare bones right now, and there's not a lot of color there. It's mostly just like a grayish white background with some blackish fonts all over the place, and that's about it. So, yeah, it's not the greatest looking thing right now, and it doesn't quite do some of the sort of reactive design stuff that I would expect when you're shrinking the window down. I expected it to do some different things than what it did. I mean, they make sense in what they're doing. It's just not quite what I was expecting. So we'll see. I know they're working hard on these apps, and I expect that they'll be pretty decent apps by the time they're done.
Now, since they're not finished, and you may still want to be able to use the features that you're used to in these apps, rest assured that the current versions of the Xbox Music and video apps will still work. You can run them in parallel with the preview apps here, so you don't have to worry about one overwriting the old ones.
Right, they're completely separate apps. So the standard one, like the standard video app, is called Video, and the video preview app is called, you guessed it, Video Preview. So it's pretty easy to figure out which one you're using or one to use.
Indeed. All right, well, we kind of already transitioned over to audio, didn't we?
Sort of, yeah. And the big audio news this week is the launching of Jay-Z's new music streaming service called Tidal. You're not happy about this, eh?
Tell me why I care.
Because it's hi-fi.
Tell me why I care.
Because, Richard, it's high-quality music streaming to your ears.
So is Pono.
Don't your ears deserve? Well, Pono is a hardware player. This is like hi-fi Spotify.
Wow, so that is Deezer.
Too much. And frankly, so is Spot. I mean, you can do 320 kilobits per second Spotify, which maybe isn't quite as hi-fi as Tidal. I'm not sure. I didn't see actual like numbers here, but I think they were saying lossless music streaming, right?
I'm assuming that's one of the options, but that's an option. You don't have to go down that path here, right? I mean, as I've read, the real play here isn't necessarily that it's hi-fi. It's that they're going to be making a play to get exclusive deals with content before other streaming services have access to it, right?
Well, right, I guess. And by they, we mean a whole bunch of, like, this service is owned by a bunch of artists. You know, Jay-Z's the main guy behind this, but Alicia Keys, Kanye West, Deadmau5, Jack White, Daft Punk, like, there's a bunch of people who have ownership stake in this. And the idea is that this service of theirs is going to help artists to be more, you know, to actually make a little bit more money off of their music. And I don't know, their initial pitch is that you're going to get better sound quality, but that's only if you pay $19.99 a month for the hi-fi version. The
right, not happening.
Yeah, the regular version is $9.99 a month, which is the same as Spotify and Xbox Music and most of the competition. So I don't know. I sure you might get some exclusives. You might get some timed exclusives, but I just can't imagine the library for Tidal being anywhere even close to services like Spotify and RDO and Xbox Music.
Exactly, which means that this is an add-on to what you're already listening to. So it's $10 or $20 additional dollars a month on top of either your Spotify service or your Xbox Music service or whatever else you have. Now, don't get me wrong. I like the idea that this is something created by the artists and that they're kind of, to some extent, cutting out the middleman. What I might feel a little bit more passionate about it, particularly when we know that the revenue stream from streaming, no pun intended, is nowhere near as good as for digital digital purchases. I might feel a little bit more sensitive to this. If maybe this weren't all a whole bunch of artists that are already making a lot of bank.
Yeah, I saw one comment that said, so this is a way for millionaires to just make more money from us non-millionaires?
Taylor Swift.
You know, here's an idea. Subscribe to Xbox Music Pass for $10 a month. Get access to almost everything that you want. It doesn't have everything, and it might not have some of these artists as they potentially move over to Tidal. So if you really care about those artists, then go and buy the albums on Amazon or iTunes or wherever it is that you buy the albums. Maybe buy CDs, I don't know, rip it, and then upload those to OneDrive. And you'll have all of your music in one place, available from that Xbox Music app on all of your devices.
As retro as that is starting to sound, in all honesty, buying the CD, ripping it yourself lossless, and putting it on your music locker is probably the best solution.
And I mean, you're joking a little bit about it, and we've got Sixlayer in the chat saying, that sounds like a lot of work. I'm only saying to buy the album or the physical CD for anything that isn't already on Xbox Music or Spotify or whatever. Don't do all that work for all of the music you want to listen to. That's just crazy talk.
You know what was a lot of work? Ripping every single one of my 600 or 700 CDs the first and second times. So I want to know, how does this impact us specifically? Are we expecting that they'll have, say, Xbox apps or Windows apps?
Well, I think they initially announced iOS and Android.
Of course.
I think. And I saw a tweet that said that someone asked someone at Tidal if they were planning on Windows Phone support, and they said it's not in their immediate roadmap or something like that. So for me, it's a non-starter anyway, because there's got to be a Windows Phone app, or else I'm not even going to consider you as a music service.
Mm. Yeah, or at least a Windows app.
Or, I mean, yeah.
Windows Phone, maybe not, but there should be some demand for a Windows app, I would imagine.
You would think. But I think
a Windows
for a lot of people,
desktop app, maybe.
Right. But I think for a lot of people, the mobile app is even more important nowadays.
Yeah.
And by mobile, I mean phone. So I don't know. The likelihood of me ever subscribing to Tidal is pretty darn slim. So this may be the last we ever talk about Tidal on the show.
Yeah, until we hear that it just did not succeed and shutters.
Right.
Aw. All right, well, with that, let's move into gaming. And hey, how about if I kick off gaming with a story that you didn't even catch this week?
I did catch it. I was about to put it in the notes as you were putting it in the notes.
Oh, yeah, sure. So last week, we talked about how the April preview program updates for Xbox were coming in two waves. And sure enough, the second wave hit shortly after we talked about the first. And that second wave included the ability to leave voice messages for other Xbox users, a kind of beefed up back end for Party Chat. We already talked about Party Chat last week, about how that was being enhanced from a back end kind of troubleshooting and engineering perspective. And now they've put dedicated servers on that. And also, they're enhancing the What's On section, so that it's going to be continuing to have additional content, but also expanding it to Canada and the UK, which, geez, in these preview things seems kind of almost unprecedented.
Yeah, I guess. So basically nothing majorly mind-blowing here. Nice enhancements. You know, the voice messages, we were able to do that like 6 years ago on the Xbox 360, so that's one of those things that when I saw that, I was kind of shocked that it wasn't already there. I just assumed it was always there. Not that I use it very often, but yeah. So, nice things to have. The dedicated servers for Party Chat for people who are having firewall issues is a nice thing. But other than that, yeah, just kind of small stuff, and we'll be seeing all of this soon on everybody's Xbox Ones, not just people who are in the preview program.
Last week, we discussed whether we thought this was going to be released to the public in one or two waves. I think I was saying one, you were saying two. I'm still saying one. What are you saying these days?
You know, with how quickly they released the two versions, I think it is more possible that they will release it publicly as one update. But that would be the smart thing for them to do, and that's usually not what Microsoft does. So I'm still going to stick with the two separate public updates.
Nice.
So updating your Xbox isn't a lot of fun, but getting free games is. And with the April Games with Gold, they're sticking with giving you two free games this month on the Xbox One. And one of them is a brand new game. It's, you know, we're recording this on March 31st, so none of this is available until tomorrow. And the first game that you're getting isn't even available yet. And, you know, it isn't available until April. So you're getting a brand new game. It's called Pool Nation FX. This is pool as in billiards, not as in the swimming pool. I love playing pool, so I will definitely be checking this game out. And then the other one, it's not new. It's about a year old, but it is a game I love and a game I've talked about in the past a few times, and that's called Child of Light. It's a role-playing game from Ubisoft. It's sort of in the vein of a Japanese role-playing game, but not nearly as punishingly difficult, not nearly as much grinding, not nearly as boring. Very cool, like watercolored graphics, and it's meant to be played with your kid. You know, that's why I bought it, because you can hand a second controller to another person and they control another character on the screen that doesn't require nearly as much effort and strategy and skill and all that stuff. So Child of Light and Pool Nation FX for free all month long in April, as long as you have an Xbox Live Gold subscription.
You know, I really need to take advantage of these just in case someday I might want to play a game.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know why I don't.
It's not like it's hard to go in and get them. Just,
right.
You just got to buy, you know, in quotes, buy them once. And even if you delete them from your Xbox right away, you own them forever. So no reason not to get these. I've downloaded almost every free game that they've done in Games with Gold. I've only played about half of them, but I've got them just in case.
Yeah, no, I mean, that totally fits my digital hoarding nature.
Absolutely. This is perfect for you. All right, well, we've also got a couple of new releases I wanted to briefly mention this week. Out this week, Oddworld New and Tasty. This is basically a remake of the original Oddworld Abe's Odyssey game from way back on, I believe that was on the original PlayStation, basically 2D platformer side-scroller game that just everyone who played it loved. And I never actually got to play it. So this is one that I might pick up eventually. I'm really kind of hoping that it becomes a Games with Gold game soon, because it's $19.99. So available now if you'd like to pick that up. Another game new this week, Neverwinter. This is the new free-to-play action MMORPG from the Dungeons & Dragons folks. You know, not a lot of MMORPGs on consoles right now. So I'm curious if any of our listeners are playing this and what they think of it. I'm not a big fantasy RPG guy myself, so I'm not all that interested. But hey, it's free to play if you are into that type of game. You've got nothing to lose to try it. And the third one worth mentioning this week, Geometry Wars 3 Dimensions Evolved, out this week for $14.99. The Geometry Wars games have always been fantastic. So if you're into twin stick shooters, pick up Geometry Wars 3. It's sure to be gorgeous and tons of fun, and you know, a great game to just, you know, compete against your friends on those leaderboards against. Those are always a lot of fun.
Cool.
And then the other gaming news this week, we have a launch date for Halo 5 Guardians. It's coming out October 27th this year. And we had two trailers launched, both during the season finale of The Walking Dead this week. Two trailers, basically same scenarios, but reversed. The first one is this Spartan Locke, who is apparently a character in that live action show that they had last year that you and I could never figure out how to watch. and he walks into this area and there's Master Chief, and Master Chief's looking pretty torn up and he's calling Master Chief a traitor. And that's basically that trailer. And then the same trailer, but roles reversed, where Master Chief is walking in and there's Locke laying on the ground looking like he's inches from death. And Master Chief is accusing Locke of being a traitor. So we have no idea who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. Master Chief could actually be a bad guy in this Halo 5 game. What I want to know is, will this be the first Halo game that has a story that actually makes sense? I'm not sure. And I'm not sure that any of this is enough to get me to actually play this game. I gave up on Halo games a long time ago. Maybe that makes me a heretic in the Xbox community, but I'm just not good at Halo games, and I don't think the story is worth trudging through the game to play the single-player game for either. So that's it for me.
All right. I don't know if I'll get this. You know, I think the last Halo I bought was 3, and I probably played it for less time than it took me to go get it and bring it home.
All right, so why don't we move on to, is this the biggest news of the week, you think?
I don't know. I mean, that depends on whether you care about Surface.
Don't say it so coldly. So we saw the announcement, kind of surprise, not also a huge announcement. Now, they didn't have some big event or anything, but Microsoft this week announced the Surface 3. Not the Surface Pro 3, which has been out for almost a year now. The Surface 3. It's a follow-up to the Surface 2, but it's not running Windows RT.
Right. So that's not a surprise. We knew, well, we didn't know, but we've heard rumors that Microsoft would be moving away from Windows RT. And so this becomes the first, I guess, just Surface branded product that isn't a pro product that is running full Windows.
Right. So the Surface 3 is really more of a step down the chain from the Surface Pro 3. It looks like the Surface Pro 3. It's a little bit thinner. It's got an Atom processor instead of an i3, an i5, or an i7. It's got a slightly smaller display. You know, the Surface Pro 3 is a 12-point-something-inch display. This is 10.8 inches, so it's a little bit bigger than the previous Surface devices, except for the Surface Pro 3, obviously. It's lower res. It's basically the 3x2 equivalent of 1080p. It's 1920 by 1200. And like I said, it's thinner and lighter than the Surface Pro 3, but still maintains all of those ports that we like to have: USB 3, micro SD, mini display port, headphone jack. But they changed something kind of major on this, and that's the charging port. They're not doing their proprietary magnetic little charging cable anymore. Now they're using micro USB, the standard across most devices and tablets out there that aren't made by Microsoft or Apple.
Yeah, I'm glad to see this, actually. I think that's a smart move.
Yeah, I think it's a good move too. Now, that means that the Surface Pro 3 dock, if you had one and also wanted to get a Surface 3, which I think is probably a pretty small group of people, won't work because the charging port's different. But they are going to have a dock for this. They're also, of course, going to have a type cover for it in a bunch of different colors. They're also going to have pens, just like the Surface Pro 3 pen, will work with this device, which is great. That was one thing that the original Surface RT and Surface 2 didn't support, so that's really nice. But all that stuff's extra. You know, the pen is $50. We expect the keyboard to be 130, which is what it's always been for the other Surface devices. It does come with a 1-year subscription to Office 365 for a limited time. And then there's the different hardware configurations. So not nearly as many configurations as the Surface Pro 3 because they all have the same processor. So it's really about storage and memory. For $499, you can get it with 64 gigs of storage and 2 gigs of RAM, or you can double both of those to 128 gigs of storage and 4 gigs of RAM for $599. That's Wi-Fi only. Like we said, the keyboard is an additional $130. And then later this year, they're going to offer LTE models on T-Mobile and Verizon. Curious that AT&T was not listed. And Thurrott, Paul Thurrott over at Thurrott.com is reporting that the LTE options will cost $100 more, but they aren't available for pre-order yet, so we don't actually know for sure on that price. So what do you think about this, Richard? Like, is this a device that makes sense, or is it in a weird middle ground that doesn't really make sense?
I think this is a necessary device for them. I think they needed to continue the Surface line and see if there was going to continue to be a market for Microsoft to make 10-inch tablets. I honestly don't know if there is, because I think there are a lot of third-party tablets out there in the 8 to 10-inch range that are really good and, quite frankly, less expensive.
Yeah, a lot less expensive. But this is more in the iPad Air range of both size and price. It's not really meant to compete with an 8-inch tablet. But then again, some people don't want a 10.8-inch tablet either. They would find that too big. But you're probably going to use this more like a laptop. So it seems like more of a comparison or a competitor to Chromebooks and things like that. But it's way more expensive than most Chromebooks at the same time. So this does feel like kind of an odd middle ground. I mean, I'm still interested in, I think I would enjoy having one of these. I'm not going to buy one, but at $630 for the initial offering, I mean, it's still a better deal than the original Surface RT was. It's obviously way more performant and more storage for $500 than the original Surface RT and the Surface 2 had.
Yeah, I mean, and that's to be expected. I mean, this is 2.5 years later, something like that.
Something like that. I can't remember if it's 2.5 or 3.5, but it's probably 2.5. But I would say, sure, it's to be expected that the lowest storage offering is more now. But has the lowest storage offering ever changed on the iPad? Can't you still get a 16 gig iPad?
Well, usually they only do the 16 gig on the deprecated older versions. So, for example, now if you buy an iPad Air 2, I believe it's 32, 64, 128.
Oh, okay. So they've moved up too. All right, that makes sense then. Sixlayer in the chat saying that he doesn't get why people like RT devices. I am one of those people that likes the RT devices. I would... You know, a year ago, I was strongly considering ditching my Surface RT for a Surface 2. And that's because I like the Windows tablet environment a lot. And with RT specifically, now this doesn't apply to the Surface 3 here, because it was RT, you had no concerns about malware or adware or spyware or any of that garbage. Because it didn't run desktop apps. It forced you to use it more like a tablet. Not entirely, because you know, you've got the keyboard option and stuff, and I oftentimes would remote desktop into machines and essentially use it as a mobile laptop. But I really liked RT and have been a little bit saddened by the loss of that operating system, but I think it makes for less confusing offerings for Microsoft at the same time. So it's probably not a bad thing to see RT officially going away.
Well, I was going to agree with what you were saying until that last part. I firmly believe that Windows RT was the better operating system that Microsoft made available for tablets to be used as tablets. Windows, as it is now, is serving both purposes. And if you want to use a tablet as a hybrid device, that's great. But they've kind of blown their chance at really making a dent in the tablet market because they're not offering a good tablet operating system anymore.
Well, you're saying that based on what we've seen from Windows 10?
So far, yes.
Okay, yeah. If Windows 10 doesn't get some serious changes soon, then yes, I completely agree with you. But Windows 8.1 is really good on tablets, in my opinion.
Yes, and I think Windows 8.1 RT would be an ideal tablet operating system.
I guess I don't see the difference there. I mean, if you're just using the tablet-y stuff, because even RT still had desktop mode.
Right, get rid of the desktop. That was a big waste. That was a marketing ploy. That was the engineering team having to prove that they could really run Windows as we knew it on an ARM processor. And it was the Windows team and marketing team kind of trying to come up with a way of explaining why they didn't have Office yet and having, and, you know, being able to work around that.
All right. So it doesn't sound like either of us are going to be pre-ordering a Surface 3.
Nope.
All right. Well, let us know what you think about the Surface 3. That obviously won't be launching with Windows 10, but will be upgradable to Windows 10 when that comes out. If you've been wanting to run Windows 10 on your Windows phone, you probably haven't been able to because although they announced it and released it for Windows Phone a few weeks ago, it was a very limited release. I think it was only available on roughly 8 different devices. And this week, they changed that a lot. Now it's available. They've added 36 devices to the list of supported devices that it will be available on soon, although they didn't give us an actual date. But the next time they release an update to Windows 10 for phones, you're going to be able to run it on pretty much any Lumia phone. That includes most of the flagships. You got a 1520, a 1020, a Lumia Icon, a 920, 928, and then, you know, lots of the lower end phones, including the old venerable 520, the 620 and 630 from this year, even some of the other less popular ones like the 720 and the 810 from previous years. But all of these devices are Lumias. If you've got an HTC 8X, you're out of luck. You got an HTC One M8 for Windows, you're out of luck. It ain't happening.
Yeah. So there's that. And again, following the communication that they've had about these updates, they want to make sure that this is working properly on their devices first. I totally understand that. That isn't where my head exploded when I was reading this. My head exploded with the realization that there are 36 Lumia SKUs at least.
These are 36 SKUs that have been released over the last 3 years.
Four. Not 3 years. This is Windows Phone 8. So two at the most.
Okay, two. How many iPhone SKUs have we had in the last 2 years?
We usually get one or two a year. Well, SKUs, that's not fair.
SKUs.
Okay,
and
so let's...
Every year, there's like 16 new options of iPhone.
Okay, so that's fair. That is fair if we're talking SKUs. Let's take SKUs out of the picture. Let's take this and just look at model numbers. If all you're looking at is different model numbers, which are usually very distinct phones in one way or another, you're now talking still 30 different Lumias.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Fair. That's just, Richard, it's about giving you the exact phone that you want.
Ugh.
It's about choice and options and freedom. Do you not like freedom?
Yes, I love freedom. Bring out the flag.
There's one other phone missing from this list here.
What's that?
That I'm sure has a lot of, especially Europeans, outraged. The 930 is not on this list. It's the latest flagship phone that they released. It's essentially the Lumia Icon for not Verizon, and it's not on the list.
And so that wasn't supported in the first update?
Nope.
Wow.
Because none of the flagship phones were in the first release.
Okay.
So yeah, I have no idea why, but not on this list this time around either. So there's still going to be a lot of people complaining, I guess. All right, so that's it on the mobile side. That's it for the news. Why don't we talk about what's going on in our entertainment centers?
All right, so for me, it's been an interesting week because I traveled over the weekend, and that gave me some time to catch up on a fair amount of content. So I've finally, after weeks and weeks of being out of date, I am caught up on Arrow and The Flash. And man, I am really loving both of those storylines. I think they're doing a great job this season. And I'm catching up. I have an episode and a half to go, but I've been catching up on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And that has been pretty good this season, too. The second half of the season so far hasn't been as good as the first half, but I'm enjoying it. So that's pretty good. And then today, I'm very excited. Interstellar just arrived on Blu-ray, and this is something I've wanted to watch for a long time. Matt Paparocki over at DuBlue says that this is a reference disc. This is one to have if you are a Blu-ray aficionado. So really looking forward to that.
And it's a good movie.
And I've heard it's a good movie, which is, you know, why I bought it and all. So the other thing, you know, people know that I listen to podcasts occasionally. And so this weekend I traveled to California for a podcast.
That's a long way to travel for a podcast.
It is. Well, so technically it was a podcast reunion. It was the 10-year anniversary of CNET's Buzz Out Loud podcast, which isn't even on anymore. But that is one of the first shows that I ever listened to on the first iPod that I ever had. And having met and worked with some of those CNET folks, I wanted to go out to their big anniversary soiree. So they actually recorded a video episode of the show where they talked about their history and what they've been doing. And I was there watching that and then hung out with everybody afterward, had a great time. And honestly, if it weren't for Tom, Veronica, and Molly, and their producer, Mark, who encouraged me to get into doing this stuff, I wouldn't be here today. So big shout out to everyone involved in that, and I was so glad to be there.
Very cool. It sounds like a lot of fun.
Absolutely. How about you?
All right. Well, I, having finished the newsroom prior to last week's episode, started looking
at season one.
Yes, season one. Still haven't moved on to season two yet because I don't have the DVDs yet or Blu-rays, and still considering the option of going HBO Now when that becomes available. But that show's so good, I might just buy the discs so that I can share them with people. Like I want to evangelize the newsroom to more people. It's such a good show.
Yeah.
But I then went to my media center this week and looked at the huge backlog of shows that I had sitting around there. And with The Walking Dead finishing up this weekend, I thought, you know, maybe I should try and catch up on that because the last episode I watched was in November, I think. So I watched 4 or 5 episodes of The Walking Dead over the last couple of nights, probably more than I should have. But that season's getting pretty good, getting pretty interesting. I was upset that the death of a character was spoiled for me on Twitter back. It probably happened weeks ago because I'm far behind. And there's just one person on my Twitter list who doesn't seem to understand that you're not allowed to tweet spoilers to The Walking Dead. But he did, and he ruined it for me. And I was especially upset because it was one of the few characters whose deaths actually mattered to me. Like, none of the other characters that have died, which is frankly most of the show. none of them have really mattered that much. None of them have really affected me. I wasn't that invested in most of those characters, but this specific one I was, and so I was pretty frustrated that was spoiled for me. And then when I complained about it to Jen, who doesn't watch the show, she may have spoiled another character's death for me if she was right. I don't know if she was guessing the character based on her knowing which characters I like or based on her knowing who dies in the finale. But if she was right, I'm going to be super ticked off because she mentioned my favorite character in the show. So I won't say who that is because I'm not going to spoil shows for people. That's not cool.
It would be awesome if she spoiled it for you just by guessing.
Yeah. She better have been wrong. She better have been wrong. All right. So that's it for me on the TV side. I did play some games, of course, this weekend. And the one I want to point out is Forza Horizon 2 presents Fast and the Furious. This is that standalone expansion for Forza Horizon 2 based around Fast and the Furious. This is that sort of weird release where it's a standalone game that's an add-on. Like, you don't have to have Forza Horizon 2. You can just go and get this game. And right now it's free. It's only free for 2 weeks, though. And after that, it's going to be $10. Go and get this. Like, if you're interested in racing games at all, go and get this. Because what it ends up being is an extended demo for Forza Horizon 2, which is one of, if not the best racing game on Xbox One right now. It's really, really good. And this gives you access to essentially all of the game modes inside of Forza Horizon 2, just with a few less cars and a few less radio stations and, you know, things like that. So, well, a lot less cars because it's only 10. But some of the cars are really cool. I could have done without, you know, the half of them being Chrysler muscle cars that I hate. But, you know, there were some cool cars in there. And it's a lot of fun. It's really, really cool. So go and check that out because it's free. Definitely get it. And then maybe get Forza Horizon 2 after you've played this. And then plus, it's 1,000 really easy gamer points. I've never actually maxed out on an individual game's achievement score. And on this one, I did. And I only played it for about 3 hours. It's pretty much just play through the game and you get all the points. And one of the achievements has such a fantastic name. You're racing a cargo plane to an airstrip, and the achievement for beating that mission is called "How long was that airstrip?"
That is awesome.
I loved it.
Inside joke.
Yep, it was great. So that's what's been going on in my entertainment center.
I love that.
I was dying when it happened. It was great. All right. So one more quick announcement before we get out of here. We mentioned this last week. As a lot of you know, we're in the process of adopting our 2-year-old daughter, Gia, from China, and we're getting pretty close to bringing her home, hopefully in the next few months. Like I said last week, we're raffling off an iPad Mini 2, which is a great tablet as much as it pains me to admit it. So you can check out the show notes or our blog, greatwalltogreatlakes.com, for all of the details of how to enter and help us bring Gia home. And hey, if you're not an Apple fan, you could always sell it and put the money towards a Surface 3. All right, so if you want to get a hold of us, there's a lot of ways you can do that. We're on Twitter. Richard's account is just at Richard Gunther. I'm at Josh Pollard. And the website is at DigiMediaZone, D-I-G-I MediaZone. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/TheDMZ. We're on Google+. We've got the voicemail box, 877-856-4933, or email entertainment20@thedigitalmediazone.com. We've also got some other podcasts you should check out, including The End User, covering the latest tech news from the end user perspective, and Richard's other show, Home On, covering home automation and control news. What's going on with Home On this week?
In the new episode, Jim Collison from The Average Guy and the Geeks Network joins me to run through a lot of news since we've had some special shows We really haven't covered a lot of news lately, so a packed episode this time.
Cool. And you can find all of our podcasts over on iTunes, Zune. We're also on Stitcher Radio and TuneIn Radio, and we'd love it if you could leave us a rating or a review. Those are really helpful to us, and we are very appreciative of that. And then come back and listen to the show live. We do it typically on Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern. We've got a chat room for you to participate in, chat with the other listeners, chat with us, correct us live while we're recording the show, or just give us your feedback and respond to other listener feedback at the same time. So it's a lot of fun. Just follow us on Twitter to find out when exactly we're going to be on the air, because it's not always super consistent, but it's usually Tuesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern. But that's going to do it for episode 322. I'm Josh Pollard, he's Richard Gunther, and we'll be back next week for episode 323. Until then, adios.
Goodbye.